Hey folks, this is Simon Ward. Welcome to the High Performance Human Podcast. It's time for another episode where we are devoted to helping you achieve optimal human performance. Please check out my website, simonwardtriathloncoach.com, for all my latest blogs and send your questions to beth@thetriathloncoach.com. If you're not already a subscriber to the show, please go to simonward.podbean.com, where you can subscribe and make sure you don't miss any of our weekly episodes. Hey folks, welcome back. Well, I am extremely happy and delighted to have on the show today my guest, Dr. Paul Clayton. Now, I've been chasing Paul for quite a long time. He's been familiar to me through a couple of my triathlon clients. So I'll just give you a little bit of a resume about Paul before we get started. So Dr. Clayton graduated summa cum laude in medical pharmacology from Edinburgh University prior to obtaining a PhD. He is a former chair of the Forum on Food and Health in the UK and scientific advisor to the UK government's Committee on the Safety of Medicine, and is currently a fellow of the Institute of Food, Brain and Behaviour at Oxford. He works with leading doctors and clinical scientists at centres of clinical expertise in many countries, designing and supervising preclinical and clinical trials of pharmaco-nutritional interventions. He is the author of 5 books and e-books, including Health Defence, After Atkins, Natural Defenses, Out of the Fire, and Let Your Food Be Your Pharmaco-Nutrition. Now, before I say hello to Dr. Clayton, I also want to tell you a little bit about this. So I said he's a pharmaco-nutritionist, and I'm going to get him to explain what that is in a minute. But Dr. Clayton says he obsesses about food, nutrition, and health so that we don't have to, which is brilliant because we've got an expert to explain away all of the rubbish and BS that we hear now. And hopefully we're going to get some clarity on quite a lot of issues that are topical at the moment. So firstly, Paul, welcome to the show all the way from the USA.
Good to be here, Simon. Happy to talk to you.
Thank you very much. So pharmaconutrition, can you just explain what that is, please? I sort of had a vague idea, but I think I was way off target.
Oh, it's absolute gibberish. It's a portmanteau term. I mean, it combines pharmacology and nutrition. And, you know, there's a whole problem. There are many, many problems with nutrition. Nutritional science has been divided and broken up into different things and are not very relevant in most cases to public health issues, which is where my primary orientation lies. As it implies, it's a mixture of nutrition and pharmacology. And we're taking nutrition, classical nutrition, as the base. But we're moving on to something that's called evidence-based nutrition, where we're looking at the pharmacological attributes and activities of different foods, food extracts, phytonutrients, micronutrients, and cross-referencing this known pharmacology against the multiple metabolic imbalances that are caused by the modern diet and lifestyle and create what we call the diseases of civilization. Mm-hmm. There's a problem here. I mean, if these are diseases of civilization, heart disease, cancer, dementia, and all the rest of them, we've never been this civilized. Our public health is a disaster. Almost all of these conditions are becoming more frequent, and perhaps even more worryingly, we are seeing them occurring in progressively younger groups of subjects. And this is telling us that something has gone terribly wrong with our lifestyle. And when I talk about lifestyle, the greatest part of that is our diet, which has degraded really significantly, particularly since 1950, but you could trace it back further than that if you want. And this has led to some very severe systemic problems, which I see in almost all individuals, including athletes and sports people. They have chronic inflammatory stress. And chronic inflammation is a big buzzword at the moment, and everybody talks about it, but you know, not many people can tell you how it starts, what causes it, and what we can do about it, but I'm very interested and focused on that. But the modern diet and lifestyle also creates something called type B malnutrition, which is a bit distinct from the old classic type A malnutrition. You're starving kids in Africa. We're not talking about that. We're talking about triathletes, for example, and city workers who don't have scurvy or beriberi, or rarely, but when you look at what they're eating, the modern food chain, again, is so degraded that we see they're low in just about everything. Not deficient, but depleted right across the board. Type B malnutrition. Add that to chronic inflammatory stress, and you're on the fast track to aging, to degenerative disease.
One of the reasons that I wanted to get you on the show for a chat Paul, was because many of the triathletes and endurance athletes I'm across participate in events called Ironman. It's big in America. I think they have one in Florida coming up very soon. And as a result of being able to do these amazing complete these amazing physical feats, which not only require a fair amount of resilience and endurance on the day, but also in the months leading up to that in the training. And as a result of that, they have this air of perhaps overconfidence about their health and their longevity, almost like I'm invincible now. And one of the observations that I make as a coach, particularly with people I work with, on first introduction, really, is that they are often trying to a phrase that we coaches sometimes use about, they're trying to outrun a poor diet and a poor lifestyle. So it's like, well, if I do all this exercise, that's going to protect me against those sort of ailments and lifestyle diseases that you mentioned a moment ago, because I've done an Ironman. So how can I have cardiovascular disease? How can I possibly have, type 2 diabetes because of all the things I do? That's of a concern to me. And I think perhaps these things have been brought more into our focus in the last few months as we've started to learn about, the type of people that coronavirus has been being affected more and perhaps become a little bit more aware of protecting our immune system rather than just training to achieve amazing feats. One of the things that's been on my mind, and it reminds me of a phrase I read where it said the idea isn't just to amble up to the grave at half speed, but it's to come sliding in sideways, shouting "Yeehaw! What a ride!" As if that I in my own mind, I could be this leather-clad OAP still racing around on my motorbike, causing mayhem, and then a few days before my time's up on this earth, I can just sort of I can pop into the Undertakers and off I go. And if I could be super active until my final few weeks or months, that would be more preferable than what I see in a lot of people, which is a slow descent into the grave. So we were going to talk about a topic that you've written about. You've got one specific blog talking about health extension leading to life extension on your website, and I'm really interested in this idea of how we can make ourselves as healthy as possible, give ourselves as full a life as possible for as long as possible. So the floor is yours here, because you've written extensively about this.
Well, you've actually asked me a couple of questions, and I'll try and address them in turn. I absolutely agree with you that many of the athletes and sports people that I see are actually not eating an ideal diet at all, and that is hampering their ability to perform. And it means that whatever training they do, they're never going to reach their biological potential. And they're going to be a few percent below, and actually in some cases considerably below where they could be. If you are physically fit and stacked and ripped and all the rest of those things that you athletes talk about, and still and capable of pounding out a respectable 4-minute mile or whatever it is that you triathletes do, yep, that's fine. These are very short-term goals, and they're nothing to do with your long-term health whatsoever. Health is a great deal more than muscular or cardiovascular fitness, far more. And if you're eating a bad diet, then you're going to break down more often. You're going to have more, you'll have shin splints, you'll have strains, you'll have micro damage in the muscle and the joints, which will over time harm you. You will have a degraded immune system, which means you will go sick more frequently and more severely than you otherwise would. So for anyone who takes athletics or sports at a professional level and is really wanting to achieve their own personal best or do better than that, then yes, do your physical routines. That's obviously essential. But getting your nutritional foundation in place is the other side of the coin. And it's only when you have those two together that you're going to be able to find out where actually your optimal performance is. So that's one question. The other thing that you're talking about, driving your Harley or BSA or whatever your motorbike of preference is at 80 miles an hour into the grave at the age of 90. Yeah, there's a lot that we can talk about that springs off from that idea as well, because people do eat such a bad diet that the athlete or the sports person at 20 and 30, they move into their 40s and 50s. And what I see is they are starting to manifest the signs of subclinical and then, frankly, clinical conditions, which will degrade the last 10%, if not more, of their lifespan. And that, in fact, is the typical pattern of dying and death that we see in the developed nations, the OECD nations in the West, but now increasingly, of course, in India and China and other countries which have become westernized. So you spend the last 10% of your life becoming progressively sicker, becoming progressively more medically dependent. And for you, if you're living this typical lifestyle, you are gradually losing degrees of freedom, becoming more dependent. You are dying slowly, very expensively, and frankly, in a way that is not very stylish. I think this is not the right way to do things. And if you look at patterns of aging, dying, and death in other cultures at other times, in blue zones, and some of them still exist today, and in historically existing blue zones, such as mid-Victorian England, and that's one of the periods that I'm very interested in, what we see is a population that did not age and get progressively sicker in the way that we do. They did not spend the last 10% of their lives getting more medically dependent or sicker. Instead, they retained fantastically good health, physical, mental, sexual, right up until the end, and then had the decency to die very quickly and very cheaply. And of course, that was one reason why they spent so little on healthcare. They simply didn't need it. Whereas we're spending, I think, 12% of GDP on healthcare. And our fair land is covered by a cancer of hospitals and clinics and medical professions and health insurance companies, which historically were not necessary. We're living such a diseased and sick lifestyle that this has become an inevitable consequence. So everything that you think you know about aging, getting feebler, your bones getting more fragile, your arteries furring, becoming more demented, you think it's natural part of aging. It isn't. It's an artifact caused by our terrible way of life. You've lost audio. I can't hear you.
Sorry. You mentioned the mid-Victorians there and your interest in that era. And when we spoke previously to arrange this podcast, you directed me to three papers that you had a part in writing about the mid-Victorian navigators. I found those absolutely fascinating. The notion that a navvy, these are the people that were building the canals, of which I live right next to. So, you know, I can imagine these guys out here shifting clay and digging these things from below their feet to above the head and having to daily shift 20 tons of earth. Now, I used to work as a building laborer when I was 18. I can't imagine having to shift 20 tons of rubble once, never mind every day.
It's astonishing. It's astonishing. These were heroes.
Yeah. And so, but you mentioned in conversation, I think it's in one of those, that this was regular for them to be doing this into their mid-60s. You know, I mean, and again, you reference the fact that most men in their 20s couldn't do that once, never mind every day going on into their 40s, 50s, and 60s. And so that is in, they perhaps didn't live until they were 70 or 80 or 90, but they lived, they were doing this until they were 65, and then at 66 they popped off. So they were active for 99% of their life.
No, not at all. They had these incredible physical outputs, very physically very, very demanding lifestyles. And they might retire from being a navigator at the age of 50 or 60, but when you look at life expectancy, they lived a lot longer than that. In fact, their life expectancy was very close to ours.
Okay.
So when you measure life expectancy from different cultures, you can't simply look at a total life expectancy, an average and another average. You have to be a little bit more granular. You have to try and compare like with like. And most people, when they do this, and they go back to the 19th century, you're comparing life expectancy of that period, and that's predominantly a blue-collar culture, with the equivalent blue-collar groups today, so socioeconomic groups C and D. And when you do that, the Victorians look very, very healthy indeed. So their men are living about as long as men are today, actually longer. Women have gained 2 years or so since then, because that's due to family planning, because your Victorian, mid-Victorian women were typically going through 30 to 35 years of continuous pregnancy and childbirth. And at that time, that was a dangerous thing. So that brought their life expectancy down. And many of them also died in fires, which was due to a combination of the open cooking on an open hearth and wearing Victorian crinolines, you know, yards and yards of highly flammable material. Mm-hmm. So Victorian women regularly burst into flames. This is an unfortunate truth. Women's life expectancy has increased, and that's really all down to better family planning, obstetrics and gynecology, and those are 20th century medical triumphs. Look at men. Men have lost ground. We've lost 2 or 3 years life expectancy. We've become less healthy than they were. And we've not only lost life expectancy, we've lost health expectancy. As I said, they were healthy almost right up until the end. We are starting to die 10 years before we get to that final cut to black.
So you mentioned earlier that we've become more civilized since then in the last 150 years, and yet our health seems to have got worse. So we've had the advent of public health systems, the National Health Service, and not just in this country, you know, in the UK. It's, you know, we've got advanced medical care in most of the Western world, and yet our health is deteriorating. So what's gone wrong? You know, is it that we've had processed food? Is it automation? Is it I don't know. I suppose it's complex, isn't it? But what's gone wrong to make us less healthy as we're supposed to be enjoying the best time that's ever been?
Well, of course, that's nonsense. When I said we'd become more civilized, I was being deeply ironic. I see no evidence whatsoever ever of people having become any more civilized than we were in the 19th century. In fact, there's quite a lot of evidence that people were more intelligent in the 19th century. There was a higher frequency of geniuses. And that is thanks to the work of some people who are specialized in the measurement of intelligence and who've looked at intelligence over time. We have actually lost IQ on average over the last century. We are not as intelligent as they were in the mid-Victorian era. We've become more stupid. You only have to look around. I mean, who am I trying to convince? You must have noticed this yourself. So yes, have we become more civilized? I would deny that. And I think that although we have developed a huge overbearing medical technology, and our medical technology in terms of the management of symptoms of disease is, of course, far more sophisticated than it was a century ago. That has only become necessary because we forgot the basics and our populations have become so much more unhealthy. So we have not progressed. We have gone backwards, and we've gone nothing but backwards, partly because the medical profession has focused on pharmaceutical pharmacology, which, as you might or might not have noticed, is non-curative, except for the antibiotics and one or two minor things like that. And the antibiotics are running out of steam, by the way. Most of the drugs that our healthcare system is based around simply treat the symptom. And they are becoming more common, and they're emerging in more people at younger ages than they ever used to, because we got the basics wrong. We got the nutrition wrong.
Okay, so if I'm reading this right, it's possible to, you've used a term, I think you said that you'd written about this, called morbidity compression, where we, going back to what I said earlier, live as healthy a life for as long as possible, and then just have a short period of illness before we shuffle off this earth. So if, bearing in mind what you've just said about, you know, how we've not progressed over the last 100 or so years, if any of us, and I'm talking really about our listeners, but anybody else who's interested, if we want to enjoy this sort of extended health to later life, it's really got to be within our power. We've got to do it. We can't rely on anybody else to help us. And so what I'm hoping that you're going to help me out within the next 45 minutes is what actions can we be taking as engaged, intelligent human beings to preserve our health for as long as possible and maintain an active lifestyle?
If you want to live longer and more healthily, do not, whatever you do, throw yourself on the mercies of the medical profession. They have no idea how to help people to be healthier. All they know about, all they learn about in medical schools, is how to treat the symptoms of diseases. And in the process, when they treat them with this increasingly large portfolio of very expensive, very specific, and very toxic drugs, we kill more and more of our patients. Iatrogenic illness, which is illness caused by medical intervention, I think is now the fourth leading cause of death in the United States. Maybe all the fifth. It depends how you define it. And it's very, very high up in the rankings in Britain as well. So whatever you do, if you want to stay healthy, don't go and see the doctor. They only know how to tinker with the symptoms of disease. That's all they know how to do. If you want to get healthier and remain healthier for longer, this is something you have to do for yourself. And there are some, you know, very basic tips. I can say in pragmatic terms, don't smoke, take a little bit of exercise, don't eat ultra-processed foods, of course, because the connection between the consumption of ultra-processed foods and an increased risk of diabetes, heart disease, cancer, dementia, and early death is overwhelming. So learn how to cook. Learn how to work with basic produce. Make your own foods. Don't go in for snack foods and convenience foods. Almost all of them are extremely unhealthy. if you do that and you get those very simple basics right, you're undoing some of the drivers of disease, the key drivers, including inflammatory stress, type B malnutrition, and dysbiosis. Those are the three factors caused by the modern diet and lifestyle that are responsible for the tidal waves of heart attacks, strokes, cancers, dementias, osteoporosis, and all the rest of these illnesses, which are currently plaguing society and making our last years miserable, and increasingly making our middle years miserable too. That's why life expectancy is falling.
Nutrition's a big part of this. We should still be active, bearing in mind, you know, what we talked about with relation to the Victorians. What part of the social interaction and mental health? Because you talked about the blue zones there, and we hear a lot about the Mediterranean diet, and I hear people saying, yeah, I'm using the Mediterranean diet now to get healthier. And I wonder whether the Mediterranean diet is so successful because of the way in which those people live their lives as well. There's a slightly slower pace. They tend to take longer. They have extended families. So they tend to have that social interaction amongst the family rather than as individuals. So what part do those aspects, you know, and particularly, again, in the coronavirus period from, you know, March to now, where we've perhaps been denied as much social interaction, what parts do those play in having a healthier extended life?
There is no one Mediterranean diet. No. The Portuguese diet is not like the Croatian diet, and that's nothing like the Turkish diet or the Tunisian diet. Those are all different variations of the Mediterranean diet. The one that people latched onto, of course, was the Cretan diet. And that was where some of those early food pyramids, healthy food pyramids, were derived from. And I think that switching to a version of the Mediterranean diet, and there are still some people who eat it, although it is dying out now, eating a Mediterranean diet is in general a good thing to do. And we know that it reduces the risk of many chronic degenerative diseases by between 30 and in some cases up to 50%. So that's a good idea. But you can do better than that. Because when we look at some of the historical blue zone diets, we can see that you can reduce the risk of disease even further if you know how to go about this. And the reason why I go back to the mid-Victorian diet was that it was an island in space and in time. It no longer exists, but it was very, very well documented. And this was a population who were physically very, very active. No internal combustion engines, no IT, everything is done by hand. No ultra-processed food at all. Some processed foods, if you consider, you know, bacon, cheese, butter, things like that to be processed foods, but very basic. So they're eating very large amounts because they have high calorific requirements of foods which were nutrient-rich and calorie-light, which is in complete distinction to today's ultra-processed diet, which is nutrient-light and calorie-dense. So we're eating far more calories, we're getting fatter, and all the stats are showing you that. But internally, we're starving. It's this kind of paradox. People look as if they're overnourished. Internally, they're undernourished. The Victorians were eating far more than us in terms of their calorific throughputs. They were eating 2 to 3 times more food than we are because they were physically so very active. Look at the photographs. They're all slim and incredibly fit because everything that they do involves physical activity. They couldn't just sit down at a table and Zoom or exercise their fingers on a keyboard. They were basically a blue-collar working population. And that is what we were designed to be. The evolutionary process created us to be hunter-gatherers, not keyboard warriors.
It's interesting what you say there, because I can remember back to my grandparents. One grandfather was sort of, I suppose he would call himself middle class, lower middle class. He had a low management job, but he used to cycle to work a couple of miles every day and cycle home for lunch and then go back again. So he would probably cycle 6 or 7, 8 miles a day. But that, you know, over 5 days, so that's 40 miles a week. He'd get home from work. He would go and potter around in his allotment to get the vegetables for my grandma to cook for tea. And my grandma would walk up to the shops 3 times a day. They were about 300 or 400 meters away. So she would go up in the morning to get some milk and get the paper. Then she would come back. Then she would go up again to the bakers and the butchers and the greengrocers to get some stuff for lunch. And then my granddad would come home from lunch and he would have his food there. And then he would cycle back to work. And then he would come home. He'd have set working hours. My other grandfather walked to the foundry where he spent all day hammering casts, manual labor. He used to, I remember thinking he was a bit of a nutcase because he used to tell me about these breathing exercises he had. And he'd go outside in the morning in his vest and his braces and his trousers, and he'd stand on the grass in his bare feet. And he used to say it's good to connect with the earth. And I couldn't understand what he was on about then, but I realized what he was talking about now. And he would stand there and he would do 20 deep breaths, and he would talk about expanding his stomach, not his lungs. And so again, you know, things that we think are new now, but these things are not new. They were around. They've just been forgotten.
They weren't just forgotten. They were suppressed by the medical profession and the pharmaceutical industry. Yeah. In the same way that in America, John D. Rockefeller made his grants to the major medical universities of that time contingent on the medical profession and the other authorities driving the naturopaths and, you know, the wise women out of business. This was a market cornering exercise. Mm. And you now have generations of doctors who've still got their mother's milk on their lips, wet behind the ears, who know nothing other than pharmaceutical pharmacology, and who genuinely believe that that is all there is, and that there is a pill for every ill. If not now, soon there will be. Complete bullshit. Complete bullshit. But that's all these poor little darlings have been taught. That's all they understand. That's why I say, if you're concerned about health, don't go and talk to a doctor.
So do we start with nutrition, or are these concurrent activities? You know, we need to start thinking about clearly nutrition, because that's somewhere where we can all make an immediate impact in what we do. But being more active, and I'm not talking necessarily about activity, because, you know, going back to my grandparents, there were no gyms in those days, because people used to do everything manually. You know, my grandma used to walk up and down to the shops with two bags of shopping most days, so she was doing an equivalent of the farmer's walk exercise, you know. All the time she would carry a big basket of woolen and cotton blankets up and down the stairs. She would wash them by hand. She would beat the carpets by hand out in the garden. Yeah. She would haul this stuff out. They would be digging in the allotment. So there was a lot of manual physical labor that kept people fit and strong and healthy.
Absolutely.
That we don't do now, and therefore we have to replace that by going to the gym. So what we're talking about really is activity. So do some gardening, mow the lawn, chop some trees down, go and walk in the woods. But it doesn't have to be sort of almost like manufactured exercise.
I love the idea of going to chop down trees. I mean, that's not going to work if you live in central London, is it?
No, it's not.
But you'll get into trouble with the local authorities. But in general, no, it's true. The Victorians didn't need gymnasia because they lived and worked in a gym. And if you add up all the hours of physical activity that they were typically involved in, it was far, far more. It was 50, 60, 70 hours a week. Mm. Really huge numbers, which we cannot actually compensate for by going to the gym two or three times a week. We don't make up for it at all. So yes, exercise is really important, although there are some shortcuts there, which I'm sure you and your listeners don't want to hear about.
And
nutrition. Nutrition is the other part of it.
Enlighten us. I'd be interested in hearing your, because these days there's a whole new industry called hacking, that everybody, but please do share the exercise shortcuts.
Oh, I couldn't possibly get into that hacking thing. It's so immoral. I strongly believe, because of my own background, no pain, no gain. But all right, if you twist my arm, you'd know very well that one of the ways in which the muscle gets fitter is through tension on muscle, torque on bone. It upregulates a bunch of messengers, including sestrin-2, which switches on AMP kinase. And then you have a whole downstream cascade of effects, which include the muscle developing more mitochondria, expressing more GLUT4 receptors on its surface, the reduction of central adiposity because you're getting into lipolysis, and increased beta oxidation, all of those good things that exercise does. But what we have found is that there are ways you can get around this. And it was actually NASA who started some of this in sort of this exploration. Their astronauts, if you remember, when they first were going off on these long expeditions in space, they would come back practically crippled. They were losing muscle, they were losing bone, they were becoming diabetic because you're not doing any physical work in space. And so then after that, they worked out what was going on, and you saw these photographs and film clips of people up in the shuttle cycling on sedentary bicycles and pulling on rubber bands. And then we realized that it didn't have to be aerobic exercise. You could do resistance exercise, and that would have the same effect. And then we started to look into the machinery of all this. and some South Korean scientist who I sort of know, a really good scientist, started looking at a herb called jiaogulan, or to give it its Linnaean nomenclature, Gymnasta pentaphyllum. And this contains a sapogenin known as adamarane, which when you eat it, it stresses the body in a way that the body mistakes for physical exercise. Now, if you are going to do, you know, pull-ups, you know, your exercise, your flexors in your arms and shoulders, but you're not exercising your quads or your glutes. If you take some of these damarains, they get into the bloodstream, they exercise all of your muscles all at once, all of them. And they respond by switching on AMP kinase, mitochondrial neogenesis, GLUT4 expression, all of the other good things that you want. And so you can develop fitness just by popping a couple of capsules every morning. Mm. It's outrageous. And I'm not going to recommend this to anybody. Or you can go and stand on a vibrating plate. And that's doing the same thing by putting, you know, these repetitive strains on the muscles and the bones. You switch on the same sequence. So there's all kinds of hacks which are usable. You can hack and replace certain aspects of physical activity. Although you don't get the feel-good aspects just by standing on a plate. I mean, I actually enjoy how you feel after a long walk or run or whatever. But you can't take short circuits with nutrition. You really need to be taking in the basic phyto and micronutrients to rebalance your metabolism and get it firing in all four cylinders, which the modern diet won't do. You can go back to basics. I'm kind of lying when I say there are no hacks, because either you eat 4,000 calories a day worth of basic produce and choose it very carefully, or you can switch on to something which is called the health protocol, which I helped to design, which puts everything into a convenient format that you can take in the morning and gives you the nutritional profile of a mid-Victorian, no matter what else you eat. So yes, I mean, there are hacks. And I think that in general, it's probably a good idea to just live a simple life, take physical activity, cook your own food, and grow and eat local and do all those kinds of things. That's ideal. But if you're living in a city, if you're time poor, I think maybe the hacks are, you know, just an alternative way of getting where you want to be.
I mean, there's one way I've thought of, and I guess you'd be a big fan of this, particularly if you lived in the country, is you can combine the physical activity with the healthy eating by getting an allotment, or if you've got space in your garden, by growing your own vegetables and managing that. Because
I've always said that. I mean, one way of getting healthy is buy your own little patch of land, grow your own food, get your hands in the dirt, get the dirt under your nails, get the sun on your back. That's the vitamin D. And that's going to get you a great deal of what you need. It won't get you necessarily all the omega-3s that you need, because really the best source of omega-3s is oily fish or edible seaweeds from cold waters. So unless your allotment is on the coast and you're on and there's a cold ocean or a sea on the other side of that, you're going to be depleted in omega-3s, and that's going to be a major nutritional gap.
Would it be right in saying now that the earth where we grow our vegetables isn't as bountiful in terms of vitamins and minerals as it perhaps was in the Victorian age? So, I mean, first, am I correct there? Is that yes or no?
No.
It's not. So the earth is still as bountiful then. So if we're growing our vegetables, they're still going to have the same density of nutrients in them that we would have had 100 years ago.
No, that's not true either.
Oh,
sorry. It's a bit more complicated. It's not as if we're depleting the soil. We're not washing the minerals out of them. The trace elements are still there. I think that where we have gone wrong is through selective plant breeding. We've gone for increased yield. And we use NPK fertilizers, deep plowing, which destroys the microrhizosomal culture around the roots of these plants, which means that in some cases, they're not taking up all the trace elements that they should. If we're selecting for size and weight, they're spending a lot more of the solar energy available to them into structural growth and the accumulation of carbohydrates, lipids, other storage compounds. And yes, that's calories, and that's what the farmer can sell, but those aren't necessarily what we need most of. We need the phytonutrients, specifically phytoalexins. Those are plant defense compounds. People know about the carotenoids or the polyphenols. There's lots and lots of others. And if we're selecting for size and weight, what you find is that the plants, the modern plants today, the food plants, don't have levels of those really important phytonutrients that they did a couple of generations ago. In fact, there's evidence that the levels of some of the polyphenols, for example, have fallen by as much as an order of magnitude. That's a problem. That's a major problem.
So does that mean we just have to eat more of those products, or we just have to get more diversity, or we have to take supplements to up those levels within our body?
We were designed to eat more food than 2,500 calories a day. We were probably designed to run on, I would say, something like 4,000 calories a day, if not more. So by living this astonishingly sedentary lifestyle, which modern technology allows us to do, cutting our calorific throughputs down as much as we do, and then eating foods which have such low nutrient densities as we do, leaves us starving. It creates type B malnutrition. The average American, I think, is now eating something like 100 pounds of sugar a year, slightly north of 100 pounds. And if you add up all the calories, it's not just in sugar sweetened sodas and confectionery. It's hidden in all kinds of other foods as well. So tomato ketchup is about 30% sugar by weight. And I'm sure you've seen all the rest of that kind of stuff. It's hidden everywhere. And so what that means is, if you look at your overall calorie requirements, you're probably eating nothing but sugar, if you were to concentrate it all together, for the first 10 or even 12 weeks of the year. No nutrients at all. A lot of empty calories. So you look around over here and people are overstuffed. They're overfed. They have too many calories, but internally they're starving. They're depleted in vitamins, minerals, phytonutrients, fiber types, essential fatty acids. They're in trouble right across the board, which is why Americans are so sick. 5% of the global population, they're currently consuming a little bit more than 50% of the world's pharmaceuticals, not to mention an extremely large percentage of their recreational pharmaceuticals as well. This is a deeply unhealthy culture.
So, I mean, we've got probably 20 minutes left, Paul. I've got quite a few questions from listeners here. You talk about supplements there. Is it a good idea? I mean, if we're doing our best, if we're buying lots of vegetables, if we're trying to avoid processed food as much as possible, taking time to prepare our own meals from scratch, avoiding using processed products that are going to contain those sugars. One of my guests, who's a gut functional gut specialist, the other day gave everybody a challenge to eat 40 different types of fruit and vegetable in a week to get diversity and be able to name them. And I thought I was doing pretty well, and I managed to get to just over 30. So it's quite difficult. But if we're trying our best to do that, are we still going to be missing out on some vital supplements? And is there a case that there should be a supplement list that we're all looking to take? I mean, for instance, yes. You mentioned vitamin D there, and in the Northern Hemisphere, we're just coming into the late summer solstice now, so we'll be getting a weakened sun, so we're probably not going to be getting much vitamin D. So,
well, in the temperate zones, hypovitaminosis D is absolutely rife, and it's certainly a contributory factor to many of the healthcare problems that we see at the public health level. But people aren't just depleted in vitamin D. Because of our lifestyles, because of our low caloric throughputs, the terribly depleted nature of the modern ultra-processed diet, people are low in just about everything. So, yep, diversity is a good idea, but that's really an old-fashioned, very woolly idea. Diversity is not necessarily strength at all. In fact, diversity can be weakness. You've got to know exactly what it is that you're eating. And you don't need to be eating 40 vegetables or different fruits a week if you actually know what are the key ingredients in those fruits and vegetables that the body actually requires. So you can become your own specialist. If you're competing at a very high level, you may be able to afford, or you may be in a team where there is high-level nutritional information and information available to you. But for most people, you need a convenient shortcut. And this, I hate to sound as if I'm plugging something, because I didn't come on your podcast with the intention of doing that. But if you want to go down this road, there's something that I mentioned called the Health Protocol. And you can find references to this in my blog, or if people are interested and want to ask you directly, you can, by all means, forward their queries, and I will try to respond to them. But there is a kind of healthcare protocol which involves three different formulations, one which is stopping chronic inflammation, one which addresses type B malnutrition, and one which rectifies dysbiosis. And your functional gut person would probably be very keen on that. And you can do this very quickly. I take all of these things on board myself every morning, and it takes me about 2 minutes to do so. And the reason why I want to do it that way, rather than going out and foraging and hunting, well, firstly, the natives around where I live are far too aggressive. I don't want to get involved in anything like that. But I don't have time. I'm quite time poor because I'm doing a lot of teaching. I'm doing a lot of researching, reading, writing. And I find that more interesting than being a subsistence farmer.
Okay, let's try and see if we can answer a few questions. We talked about exercise. For our listeners who are athletes, which is the majority of them, is there such a thing as too much exercise?
Yeah.
Do we? I mean, the World Health Organization, I think they talk about 5 bouts of 45 minutes of moderate to vigorous exercise per week to keep one healthy. And I guess that would keep you in the bell curve. And if you are traditionally doing what triathletes call the norm for 10 to 12 hours, you end up at the other side where you are weakening your immune system and sort of heightening your potential for inflammation through exercise, and adding to that if you're eating all of those sports drinks and energy bars and gels that we like to consume.
Oh, if you're doing, you know, very high levels of exercise and you're eating a degraded diet, which many athletes still do, you will be suffering from chronic inflammatory stress. You will have immunological problems. You're not going to be able to perform anywhere near your best. You're going to be way, way below your true biological potential. So you don't overcome these problems by taking yet more exercise. Exercise judiciously and get the nutrition right. You will then find that you recover more quickly, that your performance is better, you have less injuries, you have less infections. We've actually done this in a fairly controlled trial working with a very well-known football team. And what we found is that over the course of a season, their numbers of days off, player days off, with accident or injury during the playing season and during the training season was dramatically reduced. So they had more time to play together and train together. And I think within one season, they jumped 8 places up the league. I mean, that's how much of a difference it makes.
So there's almost a case for doing a little less training and replacing and using that extra time that we've got to spend more time on getting better nutrition, on doing the things that we've talked about, you know, going out to the store and searching for those products, finding out which products are going to provide you with the nutrients you need, and then taking the time to cook the food and eat the food slowly rather than racing it down like we, you know, that, I mean, because that's another modern ailment, isn't it, is not having enough time to eat the food that you've prepared. So you have processed food and then you eat it on the go while you're driving your car or running towards the tube or the bus.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, I think this is a bit of a pipe dream, or it's a wish list. Yeah, I wish for everybody to have enough time and enough financial resources so that you can go out and do all this comparative shopping and do the studies and find out what it is that you need. It's not realistic. And for people like that, I say, look, here's the health protocol. This is something that will get all your basics right. Basically, replace this much more time intensive, much more complex strategy of learning to be an expert nutritionist and then taking the time and the trouble to actually turn that into practice. And believe me, it's a lot of time and it's a lot of trouble.
One of our listeners asks, how do you get over the health hurdles at older age? I mean, that sort of, to me, sounds like what we're saying is that the health problems that we associated with older age are inevitable. I'm not sure about that. I think that they are of our own making as a general population, and that they don't need to be inevitable. But you do have to work hard to make sure they don't happen.
Well, they're not inevitable at all. I mean, we know from the Victorian data that people retained their physical, mental health until really very late in life. And we may have plenty of records of men and women in their 80s and 90s who were still capable in the harvest season of spending a whole day working in the fields. And one person could upload an entire wagon full of hay manually. I mean, very few, I don't think any 90-year-olds could do that today. A very few 40-year-olds.
I don't think I could.
But you see, their nutrition was so good that their bodies were working as nature intended. So I'm saying that many of the phenomena, the symptoms of aging that we think of as being natural, the loss of muscle, the loss of insulin control, the increasing adiposity, the wearing out of joints, the thickening of arteries, the thinning of bones, you think of that as being natural. It's not. Now, I'm 70 years old, and I don't take any medications. I don't have any pain. I can run 100 meters about as fast as I could when I was at university, which was not very fast. And I was never a fast runner. But I think that, you know, I hesitate to extrapolate from one single case history, but I know quite a few other people who follow this kind of nutritional regime. And believe me, they're not aging as rapidly as all the other people around them. Mm-hmm. You can see people who are clearly decrepit and old at the age of 50. And if you look around, you'll find a few people who are still relatively young and functional at the age of 70. You can age rapidly or slowly. That's where morbidity compression comes in. Mm. If you know what you're doing, you can put off many of the problems we usually associate with old age by, in my experience, 2, 3, maybe even 4 decades.
What about if your family has a history of heart disease in old age? Our listener here says, how much does genetics play a part here? What can I do to mitigate this? So I've got a sense that a lot of that is some of those lifestyle choices you've mentioned already. But how worried should we be about the genetic aspect?
Okay, there is a genetic element in some cases. And if we go back to the Victorian era, what we find is that the numbers of people with heart disease or dementia or cancer, it was recognized, but at far lower levels than what we see today, about 10% of what we see today. Mm. So what we think is that 90% of the chronic degenerative disease attached to aging that we see today is unnecessary. 10% is reflected as the reflection of the genetic risk factors. And when you talk to cancer specialists or heart disease people and ask them how many of your patients have genetic risk factors, they'll say 10%. So yes, there's hardcore of about 10% of people who do have a genetic risk factor, and where those problems are probably going to emerge sooner than they would in a general population. However, we are living such a degraded lifestyle, such a degraded diet now, that in America, almost half of the entire adult population has hypertension. It has diabetes or syndrome X or part of that. And the fact that your uncle had it and your father had it doesn't mean to say that there's a genetic risk factor at all. It simply says, hey, you're all living in such a polluted environment that you all have this problem. I mean, for example, if there's no vitamin C in the diet at all, in the national diet, everybody gets scurvy. And you think, well, yeah, my parents had scurvy, my grandparents had scurvy, so it must be genetic. No, it's simply because you're all living in this nutritionally highly degraded and destructive environment. So, yeah, I think for most people, the 9 out of 10, your ability to get into this morbidity compression thing, to push aging away, to extend health further, is certainly accessible.
One of the listeners said that he was with Bupa as part of his company health program, and they had a half day MOT every year where they went and did their bloods. I mean, it's not a common thing to have your blood panel done in this country like it is in the States. But he said he used to love the benefits that he got from that, but now he's self-employed. He doesn't obviously have access to that as easily. Is it worth paying privately to have regular health tests? And if so, what would one want to be investing in?
I think it's a complete waste of time and money.
Really?
So you get a Bupa test, that'll give you a health check, and then what happens? You can take drugs, you know, to reduce your blood pressure or to lower your cholesterol. Does that help you? Does that improve your fundamental health? No. If you're living a healthy lifestyle and you know how to get your nutritional ducks in a row, your blood chemistry is going to be fine. You won't need the pharmaceuticals. I mean, I haven't gone for a medical checkup since ever. Waste of time. I take care of myself. Eventually, at some point in time, something will go wrong. We're extremely complex. We have many moving parts. Something will eventually go wrong. And when it does, yeah, I've had a great time. And I'll be ready to move on to the next phase.
So, but if we had somebody who was listening who perhaps hadn't started from the same point as you and I, where we're already taking care of what we eat, and would it be advisable for them to go and get some medical tests just to get started and to get a benchmark of where their cholesterol was or their blood sugar, or do they can they just make a huge impact on that just by integrating all of those suggestions you've already talked about, eating more omega-3 fats, you know, the vegetables and the fruits and eating your own food or making your own food?
I think that we live in an age of diagnostic paranoia. We can test for so many more markers than we ever could. And actually, frankly, the significance of most of those markers is not particularly well understood. Someone I know in Alabama has just received 14 pages of blood work. I think they tested for 117 markers. And you know what? The experts still don't know what any of them means. They don't know what her condition is, what her problem is, and she clearly does have problems. I would say, forget it. It's a waste of your time and your money. Just get the basics right. And that doesn't just mean eating oily fish and fruits and vegetables, but it really, look, I hate to say this, but the simplest thing for most people, get your small holding and go fishing and do all that. That's great. And that's one way of doing it if you have that opportunity. But if you don't, then get your nutritional basics right by switching on the health protocol. And what I'm seeing, and the reason why this has now been adopted in 62 countries, and we'll probably be in 71 before the end of the year, and the reason why so many doctors are now rushing to join us and work with us is because they see that once their patients get onto the health protocol, their requirement for pharmaceutical intervention decreases and eventually disappears. People get healthy. If you give the body what it needs, it will say thank you very much. And now you don't have to go to the doctor anymore. You won't need Bupa. You won't need a plethora of pharmaceuticals to keep you going. The pharmaceutical model of healthcare has been very interesting. And we have got all kinds of tools we can use to suppress the symptoms of those of all kinds of diseases. But those diseases have only become common because we forgot the nutritional basics.
So a couple of good questions came in here, not necessarily related to nutrition, but what's Dr. Clayton's views on staying at work versus an active retirement in relation to longevity of mind and body, particularly with regard to mental and social stimulation, time for family? Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on that?
Oh, I don't know. Whenever you hear some scumbag politician saying they're retiring to spend more time with their family, you know they've been caught with their hands in the till, or even worse. I think that the idea of staying at work is great if your work is challenging, if you enjoy it. For me, I've never done a day's work in my life. I love what I do. I find the subject matter continually interesting. For me, it's play. If you're not lucky enough to be in a position where you have that degree of enjoyment in your work, then retire. Go and find something you do love. Find your passion. Follow it.
One listener has a job that involves working a lot of nights. Now, I mean, there's a fair amount of evidence that night shifts is detrimental to your long-term health. But she says she has no alternative. So do you have any suggestions on how she might counter some of the damaging effects of night work?
Well, night work isn't, in fact, that damaging if it's stable. It's rotating shifts that really screw you up. They're not good at all. Providing she's not on rotating shifts, she should be fine.
Okay, but if she is on rotating shifts, is there anything that can be done if doing that is an unavoidable part of your work? I mean, I've got several friends in the police force that have those rotating shifts and other sort of protection service, if you like, the fire and the paramedics.
Mm. Well, that is really tough on the body. You do pay a price for that. I think that some of the damage can be undone, again, if your nutritional profile is really superb and the health protocol will come in handy there. You may also want to use melatonin to reset your body clock. If you do, forget about tablets. When you eat melatonin, there's a huge first pass problem in the liver. What you need is an aerosol delivery under the tongue so it can be absorbed directly into the bloodstream. There's an Italian device, I think, that provides that. And that, I think, is actually very useful in resetting and stabilizing the body clock.
Mm. Couple of questions. Fasting is very popular at the moment. What are your thoughts on fasting, the various types, and also the popularity of specific diets like keto, which has also gained a lot of ground in recent years?
Well, the thing is that keto diets have been investigated fairly recently, and they've been shown not to be any better at creating sustained weight loss than any other kind of calorie control diet. But where I think the keto diet does shine is, by definition, it's a diet with a very low glycemic load. And because so many people now have problems with hyperglycemia and insulin resistance, either frank type 2 diabetes or its precursor, metabolic syndrome, that in general, we do eat a diet that has a far, an excessive content of sugar and starch, which becomes sugar. So going on to a keto diet is going to be helpful in that respect. Now, quite recently, a guy called Mike Lean has done a couple of studies showing that if you can get weight loss, what William Knoller, Richard Feynman, all these different researchers have shown that either a weight loss or weight loss plus exercise or a carb-restricted diet, that's the work of Richard Feynman, has shown that will reverse many cases of diabetes or metabolic syndrome. So the keto diet, by definition, is low carb. And if there is a problem of blood glucose control, hyperinsulinemia, and all the problems that that then creates over time, then going on a keto diet is a good strategy.
How about fasting, which is also popular at the moment? Are you a fan?
If used judiciously, yes. Fasting seems to work because it is experienced by the body as a stress, as a xenohermetic, if you will. It ramps up the body's stress responses or stress adaptive responses. And when that happens, it leaves you in a more protected configuration. This is how the adaptogens work. Things like ginseng, astragalus, Eleutherococcus senticosus. I mean, there are many of those. Every ethnobotanical scheme has got at least one of those. So you can get the same kinds of benefits by fasting or by using a xenohermetic herb, or by experiencing hot or cold stress, you know, going to a sauna and jumping into an icy plunge pool. So right. All of these different stresses are actually working in a fundamentally very similar way. They're stresses, which the body responds to by up-ramping its stress responses, which are protective and which confer benefits over the longer haul.
Okay. You talk about stress response. I know we've got just a couple of minutes left. Somebody did ask the question about hot and cold exposure, but if you're an athlete that's exercising regularly, you're creating a lot of stress. So do we want to be adding in more, or do those stresses that you're talking about there help us sort of get more into the parasympathetic type of state, or do they all just contribute to us being in more of a sympathetic state?
No, intense physical exercise is obviously experienced by the body as a stress as well, and that's a good thing unless you overdo it. But not if it's at the expense of good nutrition. Because if you don't have nutritional basics in place, you're putting these repeated stresses on the body and not giving it a chance to recover properly. So I'll go back to where we started. Exercise good, nutrition good, put them together. Now you're cooking with gas, as they say.
Cooking. Brilliant. That's probably a good place to finish. Dr. Paul Clayton, it's been great. I could have kept chatting to you for another couple of hours, but I know you've got a busy schedule. So thank you so much for sparing some time for us today and helping us to answer these questions, which really seem to have a simple solution. Get an allotment, grow your own food, cook your own food, stay away from sugars, everything in moderation, probably, like my grandma said, and you'll do pretty well.
Well, your grandma wasn't an original, you know, she got that from the ancient Greeks. Hippocrates came out with stuff like that. So these ideas have been around for a long time, nothing new under the sun. And if any of your listeners want to know more about the health protocol, I really want to, you know, make this more widely available. If you funnel them towards me, and I'm happy to respond to individual questions, if I can find the time, and I'm pretty time poor.
Okay. Well, look, you've got to go off to another call. We can talk after the show, and you can send me all of those links, but I'm obviously going to reference your website, your blog, those books that we talked about, the papers on the Victorians, the health protocol, and I like that idea about the South Korean herbs that you were talking about, the foods that had the damarins in. There was something about that in your blog about health extension, I think, and curcumin and some of those other nutritional properties that we perhaps ought to be consuming a bit more of. So once again, Dr. Paul Clayton, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure.
Talk to you again soon, I hope. Bye-bye for now.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye. Right then, that's a wrap for this week. Thanks again for listening. As always, I appreciate that you have plenty of choice out there in podcast land, so it does mean an awful lot to me when you come back regularly. If you enjoyed the podcast, please could you hop onto iTunes or Podbean and leave a rating and a comment if you can.
Apparently, it's really good for the ratings, although to be absolutely honest with you, I have no idea how they work these things out. If you like the way I roll and you find some synergy with my approach to life and sport, maybe be interested in joining my SWAT Inner Circle training group. If you are, please just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com for more details. You can also use that email address to ask for my special free gift, which I have for you, which are my top 25 tips on how to be a high-performance human. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll be back next week with another great guest. So for now, enjoy the rest of your week.